Good evening. We're ready to get started if you are. Welcome to Power Plays. I'm Tom Wilson. I'm the CEO of Allstate. Thank you. well, thank you all for coming. This is going to be a fabulous event, so thank you both to the Aspen Institute and to Atlantic Media for putting this on. It is really hard to pull all these people together for our benefit, and it's really nice for them to do it. I'm particularly interested in this tonight because I'm a believer in continual learning, and on my way to becoming CEO of Allstate, at one time I harbored aspirations of being an English professor. And those aspirations were killed when I took a Shakespeare class. My professor didn't quite see my interpretation of the plays the same way he did. I didn't have quite a traditional view. So I might have looked at A Midsummer Night's Dream and said that's sort of the end of partisanship in Washington. Or I might have said Much Ado About Nothing was really watching the Democratic primary debates in Iowa. So I think we'll all learn something here, and so I give you our Bards of the Beltway.
Thank you. Hey.
Good evening, and I'm David Gergen. I'm delighted to welcome you here tonight.
Yay!
Woohoo! And we did this last year, and we were in a very small little room. It was quite hot, but we had so much fun. And everybody said, let's try to do it again. And so here we are. We have a much bigger room. We have former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright here. We have a wonderful group of people here in attendance. And I'm told the bard would have said to stand up. I'm only going to stand up briefly. I don't want to get too far away. From my microphone or my wine. But I do want to join again in thanking all of you for coming, and I particularly want to thank Carol and Ken Edelman, who have done so much to put this together. As you know, they have, and there are many, many guys. One of the things they do is they're both devoted to Shakespeare. And they have this Movers and Shakespeare group that goes around and they came to our school, the Kennedy School, and were terrific with Henry V, opening up that play to the leadership lessons, and they've done that for many corporations. So Carol and Ken are here at the center, at the center of all that we're going to do tonight, especially as you see as we unfold here tonight. And the three of us has probably spent more time together in Washington than we should have. And so this is going to be a great deal about the Bard and political consultants. And we're going to wrap ourselves around that as we go. But we're honored tonight to be joined by, on the far end, Michael Kahn. As you know, one of the finest directors in this country who is renowned for the Shakespearean productions he has put on at the Folger and Washington, and will soon expand his wings as the New Harmon Theater is opened this October, and Michael has been a moving force behind the opening of that. I'm not sure without you and Sid Harmon coming together in the way you did, we would be having that theater opening. It's going to be splendid to have these two theaters right next door to each other, almost. Each of which can both they can eat both they can be simultaneously be doing Shakespeare. Shakespeare will be the writer with the greatest number of plays on in Washington at any one time, or they can do new productions. And new writers will have a chance to have their plays produced there. So it's an enormous benefit. To the Washington community and to the nation. Of course, here, the one who stole the show last year it was Michael York.
Yay.
Who we're hoping to see more and more of in Aspen. We're trying to twist his arm, but I'm not part of that. That's a show for a different time. As Michael told me earlier, when I kept on saying, you should be in Aspen next summer for a long period of time, and he said, no, I'm not sure. And he finally said, well, sometimes greatness is thrust upon you. So anyway, off we go. Ken, if you'll open it up. Can we do this without? I think we're probably going to have to stand as we go.
We're going to do racist. Okay. So thank you, and let me just tell you that Carol Adelman wrote the script, so she gets the credit on this. Michael York has just come off of, since January, doing 193 Camelots. So if in the middle of this script he breaks out into, "If ever I would leave you," we have to redial Michael on that. As Dave Gergen, we're so honored to be with you, Dave. Thank you very much. As Dave Gergen said, it's the campaign season is launched upon us, and it's an exciting time for all political junkies and pundits, as portrayed in these words from Shakespeare.
I am giddy. Expectation whirls me round. The imaginary relish is so sweet that it enchants my senses.
And what you have to know is that this campaign is, this is going to be a problem. This is the first since 1952 in which neither... How can that? No, it didn't go off.
Yeah. Okay.
Is it on?
Yep.
Okay. I think it's... Is that still on?
Yeah.
Okay. This is the first campaign since 1952 in which neither party has a sitting president or vice president who will be on the ticket. That's the most open campaign in over half a century. And that's one reason why so many political consultants are excited as they are. Yes, on your feet. We're all going to do this on our feet.
Okay, I'll get it.
Over to you.
No intro?
No intro. It's Henry V.
No, it's just like a campaign, just like Henry V had in another context, in another campaign.
More attention to the script.
As you can see, this hasn't been rehearsed. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slips, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Follow your spirit!
And while the giddiness grows for a gaggle of new candidates, members of the Bush administration begin to feel the sadness of losing power, which all people in public life, such as Dave and Carol and myself, felt when we left government. Cardinal Wolsey in Henry VIII delivers a poignant soliloquy as he ponders the different stages of leaving office, and especially the emptiness of finally leaving.
Farewell. A long farewell to all my greatness. This is the state of men. Today, he puts forth the tender leaves of hope. Tomorrow, blossoms and bears his blushing honors thick upon him. The third day comes of frost, a killing frost. And when he thinks, good, easy man, full surely his greatness is a ripening, nips his roots, and then he falls, as I do. I have ventured like little wanton boys that swim on bladders this many summers in a sea of glory, but far beyond my depth. My high-blown pride at length broke under me, and now has left me, weary and old with service, to the mercy of a rude stream that must forever hide me. Vain pomp and glory of this world, I hate ye. I feel my heart new opened. Oh, how wretched is that poor man that hangs on princes' favors. There is betwixt that smile we would aspire to, that sweet aspect of princes and their ruin, more pangs and fears than wars or women have. And when he falls like Lucifer, never to hope again.
Yo. Dave, I interrupt the script 1 minute? Let me just say that in Shakespeare's time, and Michael knows this very well, at the Globe Theater, people showed their appreciation by all shouting, hooray, hooray. Let's hear it. Hooray! But most of all, they shouted in Old English for hooray, hooray, which was hussah, hussah, punching the air with their arm. So let's try that. Ready? One, two, three. Huzzah! Huzzah! So when Michael York gives one of those fabulous speeches, we have to turn to him and say, huzzah! Huzzah!
Well, I wasn't sure if that was a Henry VIII leaving office or Richard Nixon. It wasn't clear.
Roy George. Ha ha!
But early in the campaign season, that's when the candidates and that's when the consultants are very, very excited and a little cocky.
So much for praising myself, who I myself will bear witness is praiseworthy.
Why, here he comes like a swelling turkey cock.
What is a turkey cock? Could you explain that to us?
You don't want to ask, Dave.
Okay, I don't want to know. Okay. Many of those running for office promise to perform far beyond anyone's expectations.
I would with such perfection govern, sir, to exceed the golden age.
But meanwhile, their staffs are scared stiff that their swelling turkey cock will say something wrong, even do something a little wrong, illegal or immoral. So they give this stern advice during the campaign to their candidates.
Assume a virtue if you have it not. Be thou as chaste as ice, as pure as snow, thou shalt not escape calumny.
And the candidates answer back as best they can.
Though I am not naturally honest, I am so sometimes by chance.
Huzzah! Huzzah!
And then, inevitably, there's a screw-up. Inevitably. And so the campaign manager sadly asks the candidate,
how camest thou in this pickle?
It's all too common in America that the voters get a little bit disappointed by those who are actually running and lament the whole field of candidates with feelings best expressed in Taming of the Shrew.
There's small choice in rotten apples.
And independent voters look at the two political parties and cry,
a plague on both your houses.
Huzzah! Huzzah!
Is there a third house?
The candidates, in turn, become totally disgusted by the voters, as shown by the ever-changing polls to be as fickle as Henry VI says.
Ah, simple man, you know not what you swear. Look, as I blow this feather from my face, and as the air blows it to me again, obeying with my wind when I do blow, and yielding to another when it blows, commanded always by the greatest gust. Such is the lightness of your common man.
Ready? One, two, three. Huzzah! Huzzah!
And now in this campaign, contrary to many in the past, it's the Democrats who are raking in the dough early. This is.
Can we have the sergeant of the house say right, Mike Peters out?
This is Mike Peters
out of here.
So Senator Clinton took the early lead, but in this last quarter, Senator Obama is moving up. But it was the Bard himself who had some street smart truths about campaign fundraising, especially about what contributors would ask for later.
'Tis gold which buys admittance.
No, no, no. If money go before, all ways do lie open.
take this purse of gold and let me buy your friendly help.
A rich man deal gifts, expecting in return 20 for one.
Senator Obama, of course, has stolen the hearts of lots of new voters. He signed up over 250,000 for this campaign. It's the largest grassroots effort ever at this stage of a presidential campaign. And with these, he pledges to drive the special interests out of Washington. But Shakespeare gives a warning to those in office who try to control special interests and implement truly effective campaign finance reform.
Mud not the fountain that gave drink to thee.
Well, Democrats supporting Hillary Clinton are, of course, poised for a victory. They envision her coming back to the White House, says Carol, just like Cleopatra floated into Alexandria, as is so magnificently described in Anna Barbaras in Antony and Cleopatra.
The barge she sat in, like a burnished throne, burned on the water. The poop was beaten gold, purple the sails, and so perfumed that the winds were lovesick with them. The oars were silver, which to the tune of flutes kept stroke and made the water which they beat to follow faster, as amorous of their strokes. She did lie in her pavilion, cloth of gold of tissue, o'er-picturing that Venus where we see the fancy outwork nature. From the barge, a strange, invisible perfume hits the senses of the adjacent wharfs. The city cast her people out upon her. The air, which, but for vacancy, had gone to gaze on Cleopatra too and made a gap in nature. I saw her once hop 40 paces through the public street, and having lost her breath, she spoke and panted that she did make defect perfection and breathless power breathe forth.
I can't quite see Hillary Clinton hopping 40 paces. John Edwards is trying hard to remain the populist, the man of the people, despite his $400 haircuts. As the bard observes in the Comedy of Errors,
there's many a man hath more hair than wit.
And the Republicans are working hard to overcome the swiftly sliding popularity of the Bush administration. Quiet, Mike, on that one. But as far as public speaking goes, any of the current candidates has a leg up on President Bush. Shakespeare captures the public's reactions to Bush's speaking in Much Ado About Nothing and Love's Labor's Lost.
We need more light to find your meaning out. He was not born under a rhyming planet.
And the bard shows us what President Bush must have been thinking when sharing the podium with such a magnificent speaker as Prime Minister Tony Blair.
Zounds. I was never so bethumped with words.
Huzzah! Huzzah! Let's not get lazy on our huzzahs for Michael. Ready? One, two, three. Huzzah! Huzzah! And here's what Blair must have been thinking watching Bush on the share of the podium with him.
He has been at a great feast of languages and stolen scraps.
Shakespeare captured well what Dick Cheney thinks of his speeches.
Man of few words, of best man.
And supporters of John McCain are worried because he's now lagging in money and in the polls. But most of all, he needs to lighten up, to pick up the energy level. Shakespeare had some thoughts for McCain about putting on a happy face.
How is it that the clouds still hang on you?
The tartness of his face sours grapes.
Methinks you are too much in the frown.
But wherefore do you droop?
Nevertheless, Senator McCain prides himself on being something of a rebel in the Republican Party and sticking to his independent views, as expressed so well in The Merchant of Venice.
I will not choose what many men desire, because I will not jump with the common spirit and rank me with the barbarous multitudes.
Rudy Giuliani, after 9/11, stood like a giant in the eyes of most Americans, almost as how Cassius describes Julius Caesar.
Why, man, he doth bestride the narrow world like a colossus, and we petty men walk under his huge legs and peep about.
But Rudy's many marriages and what many consider some questionable dealings bring to mind what Falstaff says to his gang in the East Cheap Tavern.
Let us commit the oldest sins in the newest kinds of ways.
You like that line, David, don't you? Governor Romney, who looks like the candidate from Central Casting, ranks higher on family values. But many people wonder about his rapid and seamless move to the right. Some think he's just pandering to the leaders of the religious right, ready to meet with them and say to them,
"How dost thy honor? Let me lick thy shoe."
Shakespeare understands the need for all politicians to pander to their audience a bit, and even shows a politician how to do so. This is a great scene from Hamlet, where Hamlet is, of course, the prince. Polonius is, of course, the ultimate politician. And the ultimate politician is always agreeing with the boss. This is the lesson, the first great Shakespearean lesson in sucking up and brown-nosing big time. From Hamlet.
Do you see yonder cloud that's almost in the shape of a camel?
Oh, by the mass, and 'tis like a camel indeed.
Methinks it's like a weasel.
Oh, it's back like a weasel.
Or like a whale.
Oh, very much like a whale.
Now that's a good suck up. Huzzah! Huzzah!
The bard also gives the manual for all press spokesmen, and indeed for candidates themselves, on the art of stonewalling. How, under questioning, to keep talking without saying anything of substance or revealing anything at all. From Antony and Cleopatra, here's Lepidus trying to find out all about Egypt, Cleopatra, and exactly what a crocodile is. Antony's doing the talking, but not telling anything of substance. It's the bard's case study of stonewalling.
What manner of thing is your crocodile?
It is shaped, sir, like itself. And it is as broad as it hath breadth. It is just so high as it is, and moves with its own organs, and lives by that which nourisheth it. And the elements, once out of it, it transmigrates.
What color is it of?
Of its own color, too.
Oh, 'tis a strange serpent.
'Tis so, and the tears of it are wet. With this description, satisfy him.
There's a job waiting for you in politics. The stonewalling, of course, just frustrates the press. And so they keep probing, keep pushing. And finally, the spokespersons become disgusted and conclude that sometimes, if not usually, they just can't win dealing with the press. Shakespeare puts this sentiment aptly in the mouth of the fool in King Lear.
They'll have me whipped for speaking true. They'll have me whipped for lying. And sometimes I'm whipped for holding my peace.
With all these candidates on both sides and so many more, the prospect of endless all-candidate debates is frightening for the candidates who are apt to echo Jacques and As You Like It.
Let's meet as little as we can.
Huzzah! Huzzah! All politicians know, and anybody in politics know, that timing is very important and seizing opportunities is essential. The greatest scene for this comes in As You Like It. And there, one of the wonderful, strong, witty women of Shakespeare, Rosalind, is approached by a friend of hers, Phoebe. And Phoebe is all excited, all a titter, because a boy is interested in Phoebe for the very first time. So Phoebe asks Rosalind, what should I do? And Rosalind turns to Phoebe and gives great advice about seizing opportunities and about good timing. Rosalind says to Phoebe,
for I must tell you friendly in your ear, sell when you can. You are not for all markets.
Both parties say they want to stay on the high road, but inevitably, indubitably, they begin to slip. Well, Shakespeare has some good pointers on the consequences of going negative.
Heat not a furnace for your foes so hot that it does singe yourself.
But that hasn't kept Democratic and Republican opposition research offices from digging up dirt wherever possible, and we've just started. The Bard captures the sheer fun of dirty tricks.
I'll tickle your catastrophe.
But if the candidates really want to go negative, which I think they really do, don't they, David? They should go directly to Shakespeare's insults. Because Shakespeare will elevate and make more sophisticated even the level of your insults. Here from the thousands of Shakespearean insults are some of our favorites.
You starveling, you eelskin, you bull's pizzle.
You stockfish, you bowcase, you vile standing tuck.
Thou boiling hatch of beastliness, thou swollen parcel of dropsies, thou stuffed cloak bag of guts, thou vanity in years.
Thou arch villain, thou double dealer, thou depender on a thing that leaves. Thou bottled spider, poisonous bunchback toad, thou rascally sheep biter.
I do smell horse piss. At which my nose is in great indignation. Thou pigeon liver, thou dish of skim milk.
Let's hear it for the insults. Huzzah! Huzzah! All kidding aside, the campaign season highlights the very wonderful nature of democracy, which brings out extraordinary possibilities in ordinary people. Both the candidates and the voters, who are, as Hamlet waxes so eloquently,
what a piece of work is man. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in form and moving, how express and admirable. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals.
Even though we're facing what is going to be a very, very difficult year of slings and arrows, the wonderful thing about this country is how, when it's all over, after the better primaries and even more bitter general election, people here do try to come together to celebrate our amazing system of government of the people, by the people, for the people. And so it is that we try, maybe not as long as we should, but at special moments, and they're often captured here in Aspen, at special moments, we try to come together and get on with the work of our wondrous democratic system.
Deep malice makes too deep incision. Forget, forgive, conclude. and be agreed.
Yay!
Let's hear it for our two actors right here. Huzzah! Huzzah! Michael, give us your perspective on all this.
Oh, well, first of all, I'm never going to be able to hear these lines in a play any other way again. But I hope when I do Anti-Cleopatra this year that I'm not going to think about Rudy Giuliani.
Stand up and tell us your view.
Well, of course. But, you know, what's interesting is that probably you couldn't have had this kind of conversation in Elizabethan England, because the kind of censorship that was going on in Elizabethan England, we would all be arrested and carted off to jail for even making fun of political figures. But what Shakespeare was really smart about was that he decided to talk about politics by setting all of his plays in the past. And while, you know, when I was growing up and I was told, well, it's really because he was a Tudor apologist and so he could go after the Plantagenets, the truth is that he really wrote about his own society, and he actually wrote about politics exactly as it was practiced in his own time. And the frightening thing is there's absolutely no difference whatsoever. and so when people say, why are these plays so relevant all the time, it's really because, frankly, nothing has changed. And the reason nothing has changed is because, in a way, we've not changed. And since Shakespeare actually understood us probably better than we understand ourselves, he actually allowed, as he asked Hamlet to say about the theater, that the job is to hold a mirror up to nature, that Shakespeare does hold up a mirror up to nature, and the nature we're looking at is ours. So whether we're able to make fun of using these lines about politics right now, we're actually talking really about our own foibles and our own faults and our own great strengths. And I learned something else, because I never heard of this thing before. So this was great for me to be here, so thank you.
Yeah, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Michael?
Dave?
Did Shakespeare believe that humans make progress despite politics or because of politics?
I don't see any particular evidence that politics were going to help us in the plays. Mm-hmm. They seem to be spending most time in politics about really getting power, keeping power, and keeping it away from other people.
Mm-hmm. That shows you how times have changed, isn't it, Michael? Let's take a few questions, and then we have a great, great finale for you. We don't see the first question, so the second question, please. Second question, right there, yeah. Carol, did you consider Bloomberg when you were doing that?
We were just taking the top three in each party.
Trying to be fair on that. Yeah.
What Shakespearean character would you think would apply to George Bush now, named up president?
I have an answer for that, but go on, Michael.
Oh, yours is probably faster.
No, go on.
I have to take a long...
well,
his
Richard
childhood was sort of like Prince Hal. Mm-hmm. His adulthood, I don't know. What do you say?
All right. The analogy, and we did a debate on the Shakespeare stage a few years ago. Remember that? And we did it on the question of whether Henry V was justified in going into France. And it really was remarkable when Henry V, before he took office, he was Hal. His father was ruling the land. He was drinking in the bars way too much. He was cavorting. He was not thought to be the son with any great potential for politics on that. He takes office. He gets office in a very disputed way. Hal did not have Florida Chads, but... it was a very disputed way. And then he gets into a war which is highly debatable, even 400 years later. And so the analogy between George W. Bush and Henry V is a great analogy. We did this debate, remember? We had Ted Olson, who was here yesterday with us. We had Arianna Huffington. We had David Brooks. We had, who else was on the, we had a whole wonderful panoply of people. Judy Dench was there. Justice Scalia was going to judge. And it really was sensational. So one of us would make a point about, well, he heard this justification and he wanted to go into that land and said, no, no, he heard that from the bishops. And no one, someone said, no, I thought you were talking about Iraq, not France on that. And we got all mixed up on between Hal and, you know, George W. Bush, because the analogy and the controversy is very strong. I think today the President George W. Bush is more like a Richard II situation, you know, where power just dissolves from him. The Democrats have really taken over the machinery of government very much, and he is there off to the side, woe begotten on that.
But Ken, there was a time around 9/11, just after 9/11, that many of us thought we were watching the transformation from Prince Hal into a young Henry V. But it's important to remember that Henry V won Agincourt.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, busy getting minds. The question is, did Henry IV give advice to Hal right before he died? And the line is, busy getting minds with foreign quarrels. Yeah, and so that was one of his last comments on that. Other questions? Yes.
They're over here.
Yeah.
Which Shakespearean character do you think Barack Obama is?
Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm. I think it's too soon to tell.
That's kind of a cop-out on there. Yeah. After he's off the is there a character trying to assassinate rulers after he was off the throne? I don't know what your question is in relation to, but... certainly, well, with Julius Caesar was on. Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. Not that I know of is the answer. Not that I know of. Yeah, the repeat is this would be an analogy between Saddam Hussein trying to assassinate George Herbert Walker Bush when he was in Kuwait after he got off. Yeah, please.
The analogy of Lewis
Coleman Powell. Yeah, Colin Powell, I think that you had, I don't want to say a Coriolanus figure, but because...
No, and Coriolanus actually is the one character who needed a political consultant. If he'd had one, he would have actually been elected.
Yeah.
So, but I don't think it has any relationship to General Powell.
Mm-hmm. But Coriolanus was an interesting character. He was a military, really a military who tried to go into politics and just never caught on. I think that Colin was a lot more successful.
Who was the best?
I've always thought that Democrats are Hamlet and Republicans are Coriolanus.
Huh. Whoa.
That seems very flattering to the Democrats.
No, I'm just saying in terms of having several ideas about the same thing. Mm-hmm. And or having only one idea about the same thing.
Oh, I see. So okay, good. Yeah.
Given your prior life career, when did you come upon this interest in Shakespeare? Was it a result of or a cause of?
Well, I never took a Shakespeare course in my life. I've taught at Georgetown starting in 1977, and then taught at George Washington. And then Norm Augustine and I, he was CEO and chairman of the board of Lockheed Martin. We wrote a book of Shakespeare on management and Shakespeare on leadership. And Bob Schieffer, we're sitting right here. The week the book comes out, I get a call. I've never met him in my life. I love that book. And I said, who is this? Bob Schieffer. I said, well, great. So I've always loved Bob Schieffer after that.
Huzzah!
As I like to say, that Bob was the only unsigned copy of that book in existence, I think. At least he bought it in the store, so that was great. Yeah, please.
I'd like to ask Michael York.
Sure.
Your favorite line from Romeo and Juliet?
There are
simply too many. it's strange. My mind goes completely blank. Do you have a favorite line? Which is? Yes. Juliet's speech.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the whole play is fraught with the most glorious language, and which makes choice invidious. I have to say that having played it, Romeo's are not a very, I think you'd agree, Michael, not the most rewarding part, whereas Juliet, ironically, played by a young adolescent boy, is. She gets, go figure.
Great. Dave, any reflections on...
Well, I wanted to come back to Michael Caine. He has such a dark view of politics. Was Shakespeare that really that dark about politicians? I mean, they had their flaws, but was he not... Did he see no redeeming quality in political leadership?
I think Shakespeare had a pretty jaundiced view of politicians, actually.
Jaundiced view.
And the whole issue, of what politics do. I think the plays are highly critical. The only extraordinary...
Does that include Henry
V?
But
let me say something. The thing about Shakespeare... I'll say that, and then... The thing about Shakespeare is that that's actually not a necessarily fair question. Because the reason I think that we still go to Shakespeare is because he presents the problems, he explores the problems of politics. He does not tell us what he thinks. As a matter of fact, I think the important thing about Shakespeare is he doesn't tell us what he thinks, he tells us what to think about. Mm-hmm. And that is the experience of a play.
Mm-hmm. How's that?
Yeah. Oh, I wanted one of those all night.
You just told me you don't want there. But,
yeah, like but it. Everybody's getting one, so who the hell cares what they are? But even when you take a character like Henry V, and one of the things that I think probably we as directors or actors do is very often in trying to make our point with the play tend to reduce the ambiguity and complexity of Shakespeare. And we try mm-hmm. to sort of squeeze the really richness of his investigation of these issues and character into a concept that we're trying to bring. That's fine, that's fair. But actually, you take a character like Henry V, who is a great national hero, and at the same time, he does go to war because the church wants to take money from him, and instead he wants to take money from the church, and the church suggests he should go to war instead, and so he becomes involved in that, and he leaves them alone. And when he's this extraordinary leader, at the same time he commits several war crimes. Yeah, yeah. He kills the French prisoners, which is against the rules of engagement. And yet what Shakespeare is showing us is the difficulty of leadership, of the fact that in order to be a strong leader in a difficult time, you are often asked to make moral choices, and sometimes you make the wrong ones for other reasons. That is what I think, so we have a good deal of fun here about trying to say which characters like so-and-so, but I think like actually the people we're talking about, even mm-hmm. in our own lives, that the shades of gray and the complexities of people are actually what he's interested in.
Yeah. Could I add something? I think you've hit the nail on the head, Mike. It's so hard to know what Shakespeare is thinking, because he has this mindset that sees from both sides.
That's right.
Both points of view. It's there in the writing, it's there in the sonnets. Always they break up in the middle. You see one point of view on the one side, this, on the other side, that, therefore, this.
And it's, I think, thesis, it's the dialogue
antithesis,
with us.
Synthesis. Mm-hmm. And that he can't help. You never find out what he thinks about war, but he'll talk about the effects of war and the ethics of war should you go into it. And because his public is consisted of intelligentsia and your ordinary citizen who came to see fights and parades and whatever, he'll give a sort of cursory battle,
But it's much more interesting, the debate before the battle and the debate after, the consequences.
So, and the two greatest scenes about war for me are two tiny scenes in Henry VI, where a father finds that his son has been killed and a son finds his father has been killed, and yet he can also in the same play have extraordinary, glorious patriotic speeches about why you go to war. I think that those issues are the same issues that confront us every day. And everything I heard this afternoon is, listening to three people, is the complexity of coming to one point of view about these issues. And Shakespeare leads us to ask those questions in a way I think no other author does.
And when you watch the play, what's so much fun is when you watch the plays, no matter, you know, even the secondary plays, you see things in them that really strike you as so genuine and so true. As Michael said, we know very little about Shakespeare's life, but he seemed to know everything about our life. And what is so remarkable is that even in a play, one of my favorites, but it's hardly ever put on, Troilus and Cressida, okay? Troilus and Cressida has these scenes of the war council where people give their views on the issues of the day. And before you meet him, there's a character, Nestor, and other people say Nestor is very old, very wise, and very experienced. And then Nestor himself comes out, and the first thing he says is, I'm very old, I'm very wise, and I'm very experienced. Okay. And then you see Nestor in a few of the war councils, and Nestor talks a little too much, and you get the idea, okay, he's very old, he's just kind of rambling on. But the fact is, after you've seen Troilus and Cressida a good number of times, and then you teach it, you realize something spectacular. And that is that Nestor will say at great length what the person right in front of him, right before him, said very succinctly and very thoroughly. And when Nestor gives this long explanation, he adds no depth, he adds no breadth, he adds no ideas to it. He just says the same thing over and over. Now, once you see that Nestor and you go back into government, you see Nestors all the time. When you work on board meetings, you just see there's Nestor at your table. And adding nothing but just lots of words on that. Now, speaking of words, we have one of the glories of Shakespeare, as you could see tonight, not only to have great actors like Carol, both a playwright and an actor, and Michael York, but one of the glories of Shakespeare is, of course, not only the fabulous insights that he gives into what we are like, but the fact that he told stories and people learn best through stories, and thirdly is the words he used. And it's the most glorious words in the English language. And to give you just a few statistics, at the time of William Shakespeare, somebody in his class, and his father was a tanner who made gloves, so he was kind of lower middle class, somebody in his class would have a normal vocabulary of 800 to 900 words. Okay? A graduate from Oxford or Cambridge at that time would have a total vocabulary of 2,000 to 3,000 words. John Milton, the greatest English poet one generation after Shakespeare, has a total vocabulary of 7,400 words. William Shakespeare has a total vocabulary of 29,000 words, off the charts. So if you tell people on the East Coast that you're going out to Aspen and you say westward ho, you are quoting Shakespeare. If you've ever said to anybody that you're on a wild goose chase, you are quoting Shakespeare. If this weekend you say to somebody, let's go on a happy hour, you are quoting Shakespeare. If you've ever said it's the bewitching hour, you are quoting Shakespeare. Hit it.
If you cannot understand my argument and declare it's all Greek to me, you're quoting Shakespeare.
If you claim to be more sinned against than sinning,
you are quoting Shakespeare.
If you recall your salad days,
you are quoting Shakespeare.
If you act more in sorrow than in anger, if your wish is father to the thought, if your lost property has vanished into thin air,
You are quoting Shakespeare.
If you have ever refused... Oh, I'm sorry.
You sound better doing this, Michael. If you have ever refused to budge an inch or suffered from green-eyed jealousy, if you have played fast and loose, if you have been tongue-tied, a tower of strength, hoodwinked, or in a pickle,
you are quoting Shakespeare.
Dave?
If you have knitted your brow, made a virtue of necessity, insisted on fair play, slept not one wink, stood on ceremony, danced attendance on your lord and master, or laughed yourself into stitches.
If you've had short shrift, cold comfort, or too much of a good thing, if you've seen better days or lived in a fool's paradise, why, be that as it may, the more fool you, for it is a foregone conclusion that you are, as good luck would have it,
quoting Shakespeare.
If you clear out bag and baggage, if you think it is high time, and that is the long and short of it.
If you believe the game is up and the truth will out, even if it involves your own flesh and blood. If you lie low until the crack of doom because you suspect foul play.
If you have your teeth set on edge at one fell swoop without rhyme or reason, then to give the devil his due, if the truth were known, for surely you have a tongue in your head,
you are quoting Shakespeare.
Even if you bid me good riddance and send me packing, if you wish I was as dead as a doornail, if you think I'm an eyesore, a laughingstock, the devil incarnate, a stony-hearted villain, a bloody-minded, or a blinking idiot, then by Jove, tut-tut, it's all one to me, for
you are quoting Shakespeare.
Thank you very much.